Guaranteed to boost muscles, manhood, and personal magnetism by 200%, Tessa read skeptically as they walked past a warlock juicer. Also an excellent source of vitamin C, Chem noted, laughing. They were both trying so hard to seem normal. It didn't take very long to find someone who'd heard of a petty criminal by the name of Rook.
You looking for Johnny Rook?
A grizzled werewolf asked, then spit on the ground. Rook apparently had his own booth in the market, but hadn't been seen that night.
You tell him Cassius says hello, and that if he ever tries to scam me again, I'll happily rip his face off with my teeth.
We'll do that, Tessa said. They got a similar answer from everyone they spoke to. Johnny Rook, it seemed, had torn a swath of bad will through the entire L.A. Downworlder community. It's amazing he still has a face to rip off, Tessa observed, after a pretty young witch explained in great detail the way she would go about disfiguring him if she ever got her long-awaited chance.
He's not very good at this hiding out thing, is he? Jem said.
I don't think he wants to be very good, Tessa said, with the faraway look she sometimes got when she was hearing someone else's inner voice. After all this time, all these identities, he comes back home, makes a name for himself at the Shadow Market, a name painfully close to the one Rosemary knew him by. He wanted her to come find him.
She came back to LA too. Maybe she wanted the same thing.
Tessa sighed, and neither of them said the obvious, that if they'd only loved each other a little less, Rosemary might still be alive, and her son might have a better chance of staying that way. They roamed the market. No one knew where to find Johnny Rook that night, and most seemed delighted by the prospect that he might have disappeared forever. Tessa and Jem heard about Johnny's bad attitude, bad business practices, badly fitting trench coat, bad habit of feeding information to whoever asked for it, including the vampire complaining about this had paused here to aim a murderous look at Jem. Filthy shadow hunters. Until finally, as the sun was rising and the last vendors were departing, they heard something they could use. An address. Once again, the traffic was terrible. Tessa and Jem finally arrived at the right neighborhood, only to find themselves circling the shady streets for an alarmingly long period of time, unable to locate Rook's house. Tessa eventually realized this was due to unraveling misdirection spells that surrounded their destination, the magic flickering through a few last bursts of power as it faded. Why unraveling? Tessa wondered with a sense of dread. At least the deterioration of the spell meant that they'd be able to find Rosemary's husband and son. But they were not the only ones looking. They arrived, again, too late. The house was a ruin of blood and ichor. Manted demons wreaking bloody destruction in desperate battle with... Tessa's eyes widened. Emma Carstairs? There was no time to ask questions. Not with the insectoid demon swarming angrily in search of warm-blooded prey. The riders of Manon would never have sent demons to do this job, but after what Tessa had learned about Rook, she supposed it was no surprise he had more than one enemy to worry about. Though perhaps his worries were at an end, the ruined body lying in a pool of blood was surely Johnny Rook's. As she launched into action, slicing a razored foreleg, spearing a bulging eye stalk, she spared a moment of sorrow for Rosemary, who had died so desperately, hoping that her husband would live. But all was not lost, because there, miraculously alive, despite the swarm of ravening mantids, was the treasure Rosemary had sacrificed everything to protect. Her son. As Emma and Jem waged fierce battle against the remaining demons, Tessa approached the boy. She thought she would have recognized him anywhere, not just from Rosemary's memories of her child as a toddler, but from Tessa's own memories of her children and grandchildren, her memories of Will. The determination in his blue eyes the fierce, graceful way he held himself in the face of danger. There was no doubt, this was a Herondale. She introduced herself. He said nothing. He was so young and trying so hard to look brave. She honored this effort, speaking to him as a man rather than a child needing her care. "Get up, Christopher." He didn't move, his gaze straying toward, then quickly away from, the body. The boy's jeans were coated in blood, and Tessa wondered if it belonged to his father. "My father, he..." His voice trembled. "You must grieve later," Tessa told him. He was, by blood, if not by training, a warrior. She knew his strength better than he knew it himself. "Right now, you are in great danger. More of these things may come, and worse things as well. Are you a shadow hunter?" She flinched at the disgust in his voice. "I am not," she said. "But..." Rosemary had tried so hard to keep this from him, had sacrificed everything so he could live in ignorance of the darkness surrounding him. That life was over now. That lie was dead, and Tessa would be the one to deal it the final, fatal blow. "But you are." The boy's eyes widened. She extended a hand. "Come now. On your feet, Christopher Herondale. We've been looking for you a long time." Jem gazed out at a picture-perfect landscape, white crests on a sun-dappled sea, the peaks of the Palisades poking at a storybook blue sky, and beside him, Tessa Gray, the love of his many lifetimes, and tried to ascertain why he felt so uneasy. Christopher Herondale, or Kit, as he preferred to be called, was safely under the protection of the LA Institute. Jem and Tessa hadn't failed Rosemary, not entirely. They'd lost her, but saved her son. Returned a lost Herondale to the Shadowhunter world, where hopefully he would find a new home. He and Tessa would soon part. She'd been summoned to the Spiral Labyrinth to look into some troubling reports of illness in the Warlock community, while Jem went in search of Malcolm Fade's body and the Black Volume of the Dead. He had a feeling that what Fade had begun here in Los Angeles was only the beginning of a graver danger. All of these were ample reasons to feel uneasy. But that wasn't it. It was Tessa, who was still holding herself at some remove from him, as if there was something she couldn't bear for him to know. "This place," Tessa said, sounding troubled. Jem put an arm around her shoulders, held her close. These felt like stolen moments together, before they turned to their respective missions. He breathed her in, trying to memorize the feel of her, already preparing for her absence. "There's something so familiar about it," Tessa said. "But you've never been here before," he asked. She shook her head. "No, it's more like something I saw in a dream." "Was I there with you?" Tessa's smile had an unmistakable trace of sorrow. "You're always in my dreams." "What's wrong?" Jem said. "Is it Rosemary? I can't help but feel her death is on my shoulders." "No," Tessa insisted. "We did everything we could for her. We're still doing everything we can. Kit is safe, for the moment, and hopefully the writers of Manon still have no idea he exists. Maybe the Unseelie Court will consider their job done."
"Maybe," Jem said dubiously. They both knew it was unlikely to end here, but at least they'd bought Kit some time. "I wish we could do more for him. No child should have to see his father murdered." Tessa took his hand. She knew exactly what Jem was thinking about. Not just all the orphans scattered through the Shadowhunter world who'd watched their parents cut down in the Dark War, but his own parents, tortured and killed before his eyes. Jem had told no one but Tessa and Will the full horror he'd endured at the hands of that demon, and telling the story even once was almost more than he could stand. He's in good hands, Tessa assured him. He's got a Carstairs by his side. Emma will help him find a new family, as we did with Charlotte, Henry, and Will.
And each other, Jem said.
And each other.
It won't be a replacement for what he's lost, though.
No, but you can never replace what you've lost, can you? Tessa said. You can only find new love to fill the void left behind.
As always, the memory of Will sat between them, his absence a presence.
We both learned that lesson too young, Jem said, but I suppose everyone learns it eventually. Loss is what it means to be human.
Tessa started to say something, then burst into tears. Jem wrapped his arms around her, holding her tight against the racking sobs, smoothed her hair, rubbed her back, waited for the storm to pass. Her pain was his pain, even when he didn't understand its source.
I'm here, he whispered. I'm with you.
Tessa took a deep, shuddering breath, then met his gaze.
What is it? He asked. You can tell me anything.
It's you. She touched his face gently. You're with me now, but you won't always be. That's what it means to be human, like you said. Eventually, I'll lose you, because you're mortal and I'm me.
Tessa.
There were no words to say what he needed to say. That his love for her stretched beyond time, beyond death. That he had spent too much time these last few days imagining his own world without her. That even unfathomable loss could be survived. That they would love each other for as long as they could. So instead, he held her tight, let her feel his arms sturdy and sure around her. Physical evidence.
I am here. Why now? He asked gently. Is it something that Brother Enoch said?
Maybe I didn't realize how much I'd shut myself away from humanity all those years in the spiral labyrinth, she admitted. You fought in the war. You saw so much violence, so much death, but I was hiding.
You were fighting, Jem corrected her, in your way, which was as essential as mine.
I was fighting, but I was also hiding. I didn't want to be fully in the world until you could be there too. And now, I suppose I'm waking up to being fully human again, which is terrifying, especially now.
Tessa, why now?
He said again, alarm growing. What could Brother Enoch have told her to send her into this kind of spiraling panic? Tessa took his palm and pressed it flat against her stomach. The reason I had so much trouble changing back to myself is that I'm not only myself right now.
You mean?
He was almost afraid to hope.
I'm pregnant.
Really? He felt like a live wire, the idea of it, a baby, lighting his synapses on fire. He had never let himself hope for this because he knew better than anyone how difficult it had been for Tessa, watching her children age as she did not. She had been a wonderful mother. She had loved being a mother, but he knew what it had cost her. He'd always assumed she would never want to endure that again. Really? Diapers, strollers, playdates with Magnus and Alec? Assuming we can persuade Magnus to wait a few years before he starts training our child to blow things up. The whole nine yards. So, what do you think? Jem felt like his heart would burst.
I'm happy.
Happy doesn't even begin to cover it, but you. He examined her expression carefully. He knew her face better than his own. Could read it like one of Tessa's beloved books. And he read, now, terror, longing, sorrow, and most of all, joy.
You're happy too?
I didn't think I could ever feel this way again, Tessa said. There was a time when I thought there was no more joy left to me. And now, her smile blazed like the sun. Why do you look so surprised? He didn't know how to say it without hurting her, making the pain fresh again by reminding her of her loss. But of course, she could read his face just as well as he could read hers. Yes, I might lose them someday, as I'll lose you. I can't bear the thought of it. Tessa. But we bear so much that seems unthinkable. The only true unbearable burden is living without love. You taught me that. She laced her fingers through his, squeezed tight. She was so unimaginably strong. You and Will. Jem cupped her face in his hands, felt her skin warm against his palms, and felt grateful all over again for the life that had been returned to him. We're having a child. Tessa's eyes shined. The tears had stopped, and in their wake was a look of fierce determination. Jem knew what it had cost her to lose Will, then to lose the family she'd built with him. Jem had lost a piece of himself when his parabatai died. Will's absence had left behind a void that nothing could fill. There was, all these years later, still pain. But the pain was evidence of love, was a reminder of Will. It was easier not to feel. It was safer not to love. It was possible to make oneself silent and still as stone, to wall oneself off from the world and its losses, to empty one's heart. It was possible, but it was not human. It was not worth losing the chance to love. He had learned this from the Silent Brotherhood, and before that, from Tessa. And before that, of course, from Will. They had both tried so hard to hide from the pain of future loss, to stay solitary, safe from the dangers of connection. They had failed so beautifully. We're having a child, Tessa echoed him. I hope you're ready to give up sleep for a few years. Fortunately, I've got plenty of practice at that, he reminded her. Less so when it comes to diapers. I hear they're much improved since the last time I needed them, Tessa said. We'll have to figure it out together. All of it. You're sure, Jem said. You want to take all this on yourself again. She smiled like Raphael's Madonna. The nappies, the sleepless nights, the endless crying, the love like you've never imagined was possible, like your heart is living on the outside of your body. The chaos and the fear and the pride and the chance to tuck someone in and read them to sleep. To do all of that with you, I couldn't be more sure. He took her in his arms then, imagining the life growing inside of her and the future they would have together. A family, more love to fill the absences left by those they'd lost. More love than either of them had ever imagined still possible. The future was so precarious, shadowed by a looming danger neither of them fully understood. And Jem wondered what kind of world his child would be born into. He thought of all the blood that had been shed these last few years, the growing sense among the shadow hunters. He knew that something dark was rising, that this cold peace after the war might be only the eerie calm at the eye of the hurricane, those still silent moments in which it was possible to deceive yourself into imagining the worst was over. He and Tessa had been alive too long to deceive themselves, and he thought about what might happen to a child born at the eye of such a storm. He thought about Tessa, her will and her strength, her refusal to let loss after loss harden her against love, her refusal to hide any longer from the brutality of the mortal world, her determination to fight, to hold on. She, too, had been a child born of storms, he thought. As had he. As had Will. all three had risen in love through their struggles to find happiness. And without the struggle, would the happiness have been so great? He closed his eyes and pressed a kiss to Tessa's hair. Behind his lids, he did not see darkness, but the light of a London morning and Will there, smiling at him. "A new soul made of you and Tessa," Will said. "I can hardly wait to meet such a paragon."
"Do you see him too?"
Tessa whispered.
"I see him," Jem said, and he held her even more tightly against him, the new life they had created together, between them.
The Lost World.
The world and everything in it had changed. People passed me as I sat, people who laughed and joked and gossiped. It seemed to me that I watched them almost as a dead man might watch the living. Arthur Conan Doyle. The Fate of the Evangeline.
So you didn't sense any kind of demonic energy or any other kind of supernatural emanation from the tarn? Ty asked. It was March, and outside the Scholomance the world was wintry white, as if the Carpathian Mountains were in mourning. Ty was writing at his desk, in the black notebook, where for 6 months he had been keeping a record of the side effects, benefits, and discoverable qualities of Livy's resurrected state. Early entries ran along the lines of incorporeal, invisible to all with some exceptions. Some animals appear to sense her, most cats, for example, though cannot entirely be sure since cats do not talk. Can, with some effort, make herself invisible to me. Have asked her not to do this, find it worrying. Does not sleep, does not need food. Says she believes it's possible she can taste things that I, Ty, eat. We'll test this. Livy, wait in another room while I taste various foods. But not the most pressing of experiments. And there is the question of whether or not this is entirely related to Livy's current state, or whether it is due to being twins, or the undeniable fact that I have made all of this happen. Magnus says there's very little reliable information. Sense of smell unimpaired. Tested her on clean and dirty socks as well as various herbs. Insensible to extremes of heat or cold. Says that she is happy to be here with me. Says that she loves me and wishes to stay with me. Proof, can we assume, that some things, some emotions or relationships, survive the grave? No, Livy said. Often while Ty wrote, she hovered at his shoulder, to see what he wrote down and to qualify his notes with her own observations. But at the moment, she was more interested in something she had discovered carved into the wall just below the headboard of Ty's bed. If she made an effort, she could push herself through the wooden headboard, just like a ghost in one of Drew's movies, who could walk through walls. How she would have liked to show off this ability to her sister. But she and Ty had agreed that she should not manifest in front of the rest of their family. Behind the headboard of Ty's dorm-issued bed, the tops of the letters just faintly visible, someone had gouged a rough sentence into the wall and a date.
"I did not choose this life," Livy said out loud.
"What?" Ty said, sounding startled. "Oh," Livy said hastily, "that's not an observation, Ty. It's something that someone carved here on the wall. There's a year, too, 1904, but no name." Ty had been at the Scholomance for 4 months now, and where Ty went, Livy went too. 4 months at the Scholomance and 6 months since Livy had come back as a ghost when the catalyst Ty was using in his attempt to resurrect her had failed him, and the spell from the black volume of the dead had gone awry. At first, Livy had not been entirely herself. There were pages in Ty's notebook about the gaps in her memory, the ways in which she did not seem to be the same person. But gradually she had come back to herself. Ty had written in his notebook. Jet lag, when one travels between coasts or countries and experiences a change in time zones, is part of the human condition. It is possible that Livy is experiencing some version of this. A writer once called death that unknown country. Presumably, Livy had to travel, at least psychically, quite far to come back to me. All in all, the last few months had been a time of great and alarming changes. Livy's ghostly return from the dead had been neither the greatest nor the most alarming. The cohort and their supporters were now shut off in Idris, while supporters of the Clave had been exiled to all the corners of the globe. No one could get into Idris, and no one could get out. "What do you think they're eating?" Ty had asked Livy. "Each other, hopefully," Livy replied. "Or zucchini. Lots of zucchini." She felt sure that no one honestly enjoyed zucchini. The Scholomance, too, had changed. Historically, it was the institution where centurions were trained, and Livy had heard the centurions who descended on the Ellie Institute speak of the place. It had become a recruiting ground for the cohort, and it sounded thoroughly horrible. Those cohort sympathizers were now in Idris, and that was no great loss as far as Livy could see. Every member of the cohort she had ever met had been a bully, a bigot, or a petty-minded bootlicker. The zucchini of the Shadowhunter world. Who missed them? The real problem now was not that they were gone, but that they were not gone enough. There they were, lurking inside the wards of Idris, planning and plotting only the angel knew what. Some of the Scholomance's instructors had gone to Idris with the centurions, and now Gia Penhallow, the former consul, was in charge here. She decided to step down as consul so that she could have time to rest, but once her health improved, she wanted something useful to do. Her husband Patrick was with her, and Ragnar Fell had stepped in too, to teach and offer guidance. Katerina Loss was a frequent presence as well. She spent more time at the new academy on Luke Garraway's farm in upstate New York, but she would stop by the Scholomance now and then to restock the infirmary or heal unusual magical maladies. There were other changes. Kit had gone off to live with Jem and Tessa, while Helen and Aline were now ensconced at the Los Angeles Institute. Livy wished with all of her ghostly heart that she and Ty could have stayed in Los Angeles, but Ty had been adamant. Going off to the Scholomance was the penance he must endure for his great crime. The great crime of attempting to bring Livy back. Not very flattering, Livy thought, to now be the ghostly albatross that Ty wore around his neck. But better a ghostly albatross than simply a dead sister. Ty said, "No one chooses this life." He had put down his pen. He sounded as if he were somewhere far away. Livy didn't think he was talking about the Scholomance. She said hastily, "I saw animal tracks around Dimmet Tarn. It isn't fully iced over. I heard some of the other students say that this year is warmer than any on record. Can you imagine more snow than we've had? It looks as if animals come down to drink from Dimmet Tarn. I wonder what they are." "A Carpathian lynx, perhaps," Ty said. "They are supposed to haunt the area." "Same," Livy said, but Ty didn't laugh at her joke. He said, "You were away for nearly 3 hours. I noted it in the book. I felt as if some part of me was falling asleep. Pins and needles." Livy said, "I felt it too, like a rubber band being stretched." The past week, when Ty was not in classes, they had been experimenting with timed intervals in which Livy moved progressively farther and farther away from Ty. Dimmet Tarn was only just past the Scholomance, less than a quarter of a mile away from Ty's room, but it was the farthest Livy had ventured. She had hovered over the surface of the water for so long, she had almost begun to feel hypnotized by the unmoving black stillness beneath her. She had been able to see the reflection of leafless trees on the tarn. But no matter how close she pressed her face to the flat, inky surface of the water, she had not been able to see herself. She could see her hand if she held it out, but not the reflection of her hand. And that had made her feel very strange. So instead she looked only at the water and tried to let go of all of her unhappinesses and worries. The only thing to hold on to was Ty. So eventually she had withdrawn her attention from Dimmet Tarn, and she had come back to him. She said, "I would have liked to see a Carpathian lynx." "They're endangered," Ty said. and very shy. And I'm very invisible, Livy said, so I feel my chances are quite good. But please mark down that Dimmitt Tarn is quite an ordinary tarn. Those old stories, I think, must be only that, stories.
Further investigation required, let us say, Ty said. I will continue to do research in the library.
They had picked Dimmitt Tarn as a destination for Livy, not only because the distance was a useful measure, but because there were lots of interesting stories about Dimmitt Tarn among the other students at the Scholomance. It had once been a place of great uncanniness, supposedly, but none of the stories were in agreement as to the nature of its uncanniness. Some stories said that it was once a place beloved of the fairies. Others said that there was a great clutch of demonic eggs far down at the bottom of the tarn, so deep down that no sounding rope could give a true measure. Another story said that an unhappy warlock had enchanted the water, so that to swim in it would curse the swimmer with a toe fungus that eventually hatched miniature blue and green toadstools, which sounded improbable. But then warlocks were often improbably petty. It was one of the potential side effects of immortality. You got very bad at letting go of things.
Did you try to submerge yourself?
Ty asked. Yes, Livy said. Much like pushing through a headboard, she had been able to push herself down into the water. It had been nothing like swimming had been back in Los Angeles, where the water was green or blue or gray, depending on the time of day and whether the sun was shining. And all the waves wore a cap of white froth and came rushing up noisily on the wet sand. Dimmitt Tarn was black, utterly black. As black as night, but without stars or moon or the promise that dawn would ever come. Black as tar, black as nothingness. Livy had not felt the water of Dimmitt Tarn, but she had sunk into it all the same, slowly, until her head was beneath the surface. Darkness below her, the suggestion of the winter sky above shrinking until it was gone altogether, and she saw and felt nothing. She had sunk down and down into that void, that blackness, that nothingness, until it was not clear to her whether she was still sinking at all. Nothingness was all around her. Only that strand that connected her to Ty remained, as thin as it could be and yet stronger than the strongest metal. She and Ty had theorized that perhaps since she was now, as a ghost, uncanny herself, she might be able to discover the secret of Dimmitt Tarn. Livy had liked the idea she might have a superpower of some kind, be useful in some way, and Ty liked the idea that there might be a local mystery that they could solve. But if Dimmitt Tarn was keeping an occult secret, Livy had not discovered it. "They're going to ring the bell for dinner soon," Livy said.
"I hope it's not olive loaf," Ty said.
"It is," Livy said. "Can't you smell it?"
"Ugh,"
Ty said. He put down the black notebook and picked up the red one in which he kept his timetables. He flipped back a page and said, "That's 3 times in 4 weeks. Livy had worried about what it would be like for her brother, to be so far away from home, but Ty had adapted surprisingly well. He'd drawn up a schedule for himself on the first night, and he followed it faithfully. He laid out his clothes each night for the following morning, and before he fell asleep, he checked his alarm clock against the watch he wore around his wrist. Ty kept one of Julian's old empty lighters in the pocket of his jeans, for when he needed to keep his fingers busy, and he wore his headphones around his neck during classes, like a kind of talisman. After he'd failed to resurrect Livy from the dead, Ty had thrown his phone into the Pacific Ocean so he wouldn't be tempted to try other spells from the Black Volume. He had a new phone now, but he hadn't uploaded his photos. More penance, Livy thought, although Ty hadn't said so. Instead, he had a triptych of paintings by Julian on the wall above his desk. One of their parents, one of all the Blackthorn siblings and Diana and Emma, with the ocean behind them. The third painting was of Livy, and Livy often found herself staring at it so that she wouldn't forget her own face. Not being able to see herself in a mirror was not a big deal, compared to other parts of being dead. But all the same, it was not very pleasant. Ty wrote a letter to Julian every week, And he wrote Drew and Mark and Diana and Tavi and Helen postcards. But Livy couldn't help but notice he never wrote Kit at all. She knew Kit had been angry at Ty for trying the resurrection spell, but surely Kit had gotten over that by now. If she brought up Kit, though, Ty shrugged and put his headphones on. In general, though, Ty seemed to be fitting in just fine at the Scholomance. Better than Livy would have imagined before her death, had she imagined such a thing. Ty hadn't made any friends, but he managed everything that the instructors asked of him. And if he was mostly quiet or withdrawn otherwise, no one seemed to think that was strange. There were a lot of Shadowhunter kids at the Scholomance now who were worried or afraid, or occasionally went off to cry in a corner. Ty was keeping his head down. No one except for Livy and maybe Julian would have known there was something wrong. But there was something wrong, and Livy had no idea how to fix it, especially since she had no idea what was wrong. All she could do was be there. She had promised him that she would always be there. He had saved her from death, and she loved him. Anyway, she didn't have anywhere else to be. Sometimes, while Ty was studying or sleeping, she went exploring. To the library, where the great silvery tree grew through the broken ceiling like a promise that no wall or hardship, or promise, endured forever. Sometimes she lingered by a student reading by themselves in the library, or perched on a window ledge looking out at Dimmitt Tarn. She would press all her attention upon them, testing them to see if she could make herself known. "Can you see me? Can you see me?" But no one saw her. Once, late at night, Livy came across two girls kissing in an alcove, one with curly black hair and the other fair. They were only a year or two older than she, and Livy wondered if this was their first kiss. The fair-headed one drew back at last and said, "It's late. I should get back to my room. Books aren't going to read themselves." The curly-haired girl sighed but said, "Okay, but that's true of kisses, too. I'm not going to make out with myself." The other said, "Good point." But this time the curly-haired girl was the one who broke away from the embrace. Laughing, she said, "Okay, okay. It's late and you've got the kissing thing down, top marks. And there'll be time for more kissing later. So much time for so much kissing. Go read your books. See you at practice tomorrow?" "Sure," the fair-haired girl said, and ducked her head blushing. Livy trailed her all the way back to her room. "Can you see me? Can't you see?" she demanded. "Life is short, oh, can't you see? There's less time than you think and then it's gone." Sometimes Livy wondered if she was going crazy. But it was easier in the day when Ty was awake. Then she wasn't so alone. After dinner, which was indeed olive loaf, while he was getting ready for bed, Ty said, "Everyone keeps talking about Idris, about what might be going on in there." "Jerks being jerks is what's going on there," Livy said. "No one can get in because of the wards," Ty said. "But I was listening to them and I had an idea. No one can get in, but what if you could get in?"
"Me?" Livy said.
"You," Ty said. "Why not? You can pass through all sorts of things. Walls, doors. We could at least test it."
"Well," Livy began and then was silent.
A feeling came over her, and she realized that the feeling was excitement. She grinned back at her twin. "You're right," she said. "We should at least test it." "Tomorrow, after volcanoes and the demons that dwell in them," Ty said. He made a note in his schedule. But that night, while Ty was sleeping, Livy found herself pulled toward Dimmitt Tarn again, toward the nothingness of its depths. Every time she thought of Idris and the experiment that she and Ty would try tomorrow, she thought of her own death, of the blow that Annabelle had struck, that moment of pain and dislocation, the stricken look on Julian's face as she fled her body. Of course Annabelle wasn't in Idris now. Annabelle was dead. And of course, even if Annabelle had still been alive, Livy shouldn't be afraid of her murderer. A shadow hunter shouldn't be afraid. But the thought of her own body on the cold stone of the Accords Hall, the thought of her body burnt upon a pyre,
The thought of Lake Lynn, where she had returned. All of these pursued her as she sank into the blackness of Dimmitt Tarn and let its nothingness hide her. It was almost morning when at last she rose up, pearly light already sliding over the crust of snow around the tarn. And there, too, on the lip of the tarn was a small crumpled heap, as if someone had dropped their hat or scarf. Livy drew near and saw that it was a kitten, starved and motionless. Its paws were torn by the ice, and there were marks of bright blood in the snow. Its ears were long, tipped in black, and its coat was spotted with black as well.
"You poor thing," Livy said, and the kitten opened its eyes. It looked right at Livy and snarled noiselessly. Then its eyes closed again.
Livy fled back to the Skolomance to Ty.
"Wake up, Ty," she said. "Hurry, wake up, wake up."
Ty sat bolt upright.
"What is it? What's wrong?"
"There's a Carpathian lynx down by Dimmitt Tarn," Livy said.
"A kitten, I think it's dying. Hurry, Ty."
He threw a coat over his pajamas and pulled on his boots. He bundled up a blanket in his arms.
"Show me," he said.
The kitten was still alive when they got back to Dimmitt Tarn, Ty's boots breaking through the snow with each step. He sank, sometimes to his knees. But Livy, of course, floated above the snow. There were advantages sometimes to being dead. Livy could admit that. You could see the small rise and fall of the lynx's chest. Small wisps of breath rose from its black nose.
"Is it going to be okay?" Livy asked. "Will it live?"
Ty knelt down in the bank of snow beside the lynx. He began to wrap it in the blanket.
"I don't know," he said. "But if it lives, it will be because you saved it, Livy."
"No," Livy said. "I found it, but I can't save it. You'll have to be the one who saves it."
"Then we'll both have saved it," Ty said, and smiled at her.
If Livy had a notebook, she would have written it down. It had been a long time since she'd seen her brother smile. Ty found a box and put an old sweater in it. From the kitchen he got a plate of chicken casserole and a bowl to fill with water. When the lynx wouldn't eat or drink, he went to the infirmary and asked Katerina Loss what to do. She says to moisten a piece of cloth, a t-shirt maybe, or a hand towel, and then drip water into its mouth.
"Then do it," Livy said anxiously. How useless she felt.
"Katerina gave me a hot water bottle too," Ty said. He reached into the box and unwrapped the bundle of blanket enough to put the hot water bottle in as well. Then he began to drip water into the lynx's mouth until the fur was wet all around its face. Ty was more patient than Livy thought she could have been. He dipped the small section of t-shirt sleeve into the bowl of water and then wrung it out gently, until the animal's mouth opened and a pink tongue poked out. Ty dripped the water onto the tongue, and when the lynx swallowed it, he picked up the bowl and tipped it slowly so that the lynx could drink without moving its head. After that, he tore the chicken into small pieces and fed the pieces to it. The lynx ate ravenously, making small angry noises. At last, the chicken was gone.
"Go get more," Livy said.
Ty said, "No, Katerina said not to let it eat too much at first." He tucked a towel in around the lynx and then covered over the box with a jacket.
"We'll let it sleep now. I'll give it more later."
"What about a name?
Are you going to give it a name?"
Ty scratched his head. Livy saw with a pang that he had the faintest beginning of a beard on his face. But he, of course, would continue to grow older. One day he would be a man, but she would always be a child. Ty said, gaze fixed on one black-tipped ear, all that was visible of the lynx. "But we don't know if it's a boy or a girl."
"Then we can give it a gender-neutral name," Livy said. "Like Stripes or Hero or Commander Kitty."
"Let's see if it lives first," Ty said. By mutual agreement, they put off the plan to test Livy's capabilities to bypass the boundaries of Idris until the next day. Ty attended his classes, and Livy watched over the lynx, and in between Ty's classes, he supplied their ever more lively captive with scraps of food and bowls of milk. By the time the dinner bells were ringing, they had ascertained the lynx's gender, and Ty's arms were bloody with scratches. But the lynx was asleep and purring in his lap. There was a makeshift litter box in the closet,
and as it turned out, Ty's fidget toys also made excellent cat toys.
Irene, Ty said. Once again, Livy saw he was smiling. Let's call her Irene.
In the end, he skipped dinner altogether, and that night Livy did not go back to Dimmitt Tarn. Instead, she watched over her brother, Irene curled around his head on the pillow, her glowing eyes closing and opening, always fixed on Livy.
There was a new note in Ty's book. It said, Lynx sees her. Is this because the Lynx, have given her a name, Irene, was close to death? Or because she is a cat, though larger than house cats? Inconclusive. More research needed. Though large cats may be hard to come by. If it hadn't been for the matter of Idris, Livy could have spent the whole next day playing with Irene. She and Ty had discovered that if Livy drew her foot along the ground back and forth, Irene would try to pounce over and over. She could not understand why she couldn't catch Livy.
Like a laser pointer, Ty said. You're the red dot that always escapes.
That's me, Livy said. The elusive red dot.
So, Idris, how do we do this?
Shadow hunters used portals to go to Idris. Only now Idris was warded and portals wouldn't work. Livy, being dead, didn't need portals. When Ty had come to the Scholomance, he had stepped through a portal, and Livy had willed herself to go with Ty, to be in the place where Ty was. Ty said, it should be the same as Dimmitt Tarn, or when I'm in class and suddenly you just show up. Hold Idris in your mind like a picture. Let yourself go there.
You make it sound easy, Livy said.
Something ought to be easy, Ty said. Everything can't be hard all the time.
Fine, Livy said. Here we go. She thought of Idris, of Lake Lynn, of the moment she was no longer dead. Saw it in her mind and held it there. And then she was no longer in the room with Ty and Irene. Instead, she was floating above the great stillness of Dimmitt Tarn.
Great job, Livy, she told herself. But she didn't go back to Ty. Instead, she thought of Idris once more, and imagined, this time, that she was alive again. She thought of how once, when she had been very young, she had portaled with her family from the beach outside the LA Institute into Idris. Had that been the first time she'd gone to Idris? She closed her eyes, opened them, and found herself beside the ocean in L.A. The sun was just coming up, turning the foam atop the waves to fiery lace. And there was the institute where her family would be waking up soon, making breakfast. Did they think of her? Dream of her and then wake and think of her again? This isn't where I want to be, she said, and knew it wasn't true. She tried again. This isn't where I'm supposed to be. The sun was rising, and she tried to feel its warmth, something other than its brightness, to warm herself. What she would have given to feel the wet velvet crust of the top layer of sand under her feet, to feel the cold grittiness of the sand underneath change in temperature as the warmth of her human feet soaked away, to scream herself hoarse, knowing that no one would hear over the roar of the surf. She squatted and tried with every particle of herself to pick up a piece of beach glass. But it was a useless endeavor. She had no more effect on the world than a fragment of dream. It seemed to her, in fact, that she was shrinking, growing smaller and smaller until she no longer stood on the sand, but was instead slipping between the icy grains, now large as boulders around her. No, she said, and was no longer on the beach in Los Angeles. Instead, she was back at Dimmitt Tarn, her bare feet skimming the deep black. Get a grip on yourself, she told herself sternly, and try again. What's the worst that could happen? This time, instead of thinking of Idris, Livy thought of the way in which it was bounded. She thought of the wards that kept out everyone who was not welcome. She imagined Idris, picturing the terrible dessert they served at least once a month at the Scholomance, in which unidentifiable pieces of fruit were embedded in a vast jello dome. There were certain advantages to being dead. You were not expected to be enthusiastic about terrible desserts simply because they were desserts. But nevertheless, even dead, she remembered the consistency of jello,
and she imagined Idris as if it had been encased in gelatin instead of magic. She imagined traveling to Idris, to the shore of Lake Lynn, as if she were pressing up against a jello mold. Doing this, she could almost feel the wards of Idris resisting her, tingling, slippery, and only the slightest bit yielding. Still, she persisted, imagining pressing all of her incorporeal self against their magic. Livy closed her eyes, and when she opened them, she was in a green meadow where she had never been before. There were sugar-white mountains against the horizon and insects buzzing languorously like secrets in among the blades of grass. She was not in Idris. What was even the point of being a ghost if you didn't get to infiltrate the bad guy's lair in order to haunt jerks like the cohort? This would prove that you fail at life, Livy, except, you know, she said to herself, and then was surprised because it seemed that someone had heard and was answering her. If they failed, would it really matter? The voice said. A male voice with a strong Spanish accent. Livy could see no one, but she could hear the voice as if the speaker stood beside her. Then we could fight. I'm tired of this. We've been sitting around on our asses for months now, eating basic rations and arguing about the pettiest of goals. Shut up, Manuel, said a voice that Livy knew. Zara. And now she recognized Manuel's voice as well. We've been told to check the wards, and so we'll check the wards. Obedience is a virtue in a shadow hunter. So is patience. Patience, Manuel said. Like you've ever practiced patience in your life, Zara. Livy could see nothing but the meadow around her, the far white peaks of the mountain range. But she found that she could feel Idris, warded against her, pressing against her consciousness. Though she couldn't penetrate the wards, apparently she could eavesdrop through them. They must be standing right there. Livy on one side of the wards, and Zara and Manuel on the other. I am practicing enormous patience right now in not killing you, Zara retorted. I wish you would, Manuel said. Then I wouldn't have to suffer through another dinner of dandelion greens and half a parsnip garnished with unseasoned pigeon, while your father's cronies bicker about whether we mark the start of the New Age by naming ourselves Raziel's Chosen Angels, or the Birthright, or the Glorious Front. Why not just call ourselves super amazing people who did the right thing but now have run out of coffee and staples? You think with your stomach, Zara said. Manuel ignored this. Meanwhile, out there, there are downworlders having baguettes slathered with brie, and chocolate chip cookies, and vats of coffee. Do you know how awful it is to spy on people who are eating delicious things like chocolate croissants when you don't even have a cube of sugar? By the angel, I never thought I would say this, but I miss the food at the Scholomance. What I would give for olive loaf. Olive loaf. Livy thought, I'm dead and I wouldn't eat olive loaf. But then I wouldn't hang out with Zara either. She could still see nothing of Idris inside the wards, but as she tried to push through again, glittering symbols she did not recognize appeared, hanging in the air. This will be a brief chapter in the history of the Imperishable Order, Zara said. Or whatever historians end up calling us. Anyway, the point is, when we see that the time is right to leave Idris, and we have the whole world to set to rights, no one is going to bother recording that you missed olive loaf. They're going to write about all the battles that we won, and how good we looked winning them, and how all our enemies like Emma Carstairs died pitifully choking on their own pleas for mercy. Last time I looked, she was partying on a beach, Manuel said, as if she wasn't thinking about us at all. Good, Zara said. Let them not think about us, and then let us be the last thing they ever see. Come on, the wards are holding. Let's get back before there's nothing left for lunch. And like that, the voices were gone. Livy was alone in the green meadow, Idris as inaccessible as ever. But she had succeeded, sort of, hadn't she? She hadn't gotten past the wards, but she had gathered information. She'd learned what? That the cohort was low on food and just as unpleasant as ever. They had some sort of plan to emerge at some unknown date from Idris, in some kind of surprise attack. Most important, they seemed to be able to spy, somehow, on the outside world. She should go back to Ty and report what she learned. All she had to do was tug on that strand of necromantical magic that connected her to Ty, and she would go flying back. This was the farthest she'd ever gone from her twin. And it was not entirely a comfortable sensation.
And yet, it was a sensation, and Livy found herself savoring it. There was so little left to feel. For months now she had been less than a shadow at Ty's heels. Now, stretched so far away from him, she felt both more and less solid than she had been. She sank into the grassy meadow, feeling herself growing smaller and smaller until the blades of grass towered around her. The noise of the insects changed. Where before it had been shrill, now it slowed and grew thunderous. Why could she hear and see but not touch anything? She stretched out her hand toward a towering stalk of grass and then drew it back with a gasp. There was a bead of blood on her palm as if she had cut herself on the green edge. And when she raised her hand to her mouth, her blood was the most delicious thing she had ever tasted. She closed her eyes, savoring the taste, and when she opened them again, she was floating above the placid black nothing of Dimmitt Tarn. There was something she was supposed to do. There was someone who knew her, who knew what she should be doing. She could feel them tugging at her, as if she were a balloon on a tenuous string. They were pulling her away from the black reflected surface in which she could see no face, hard as she looked, and she let herself be reeled in. Then she was in a room with a tall, rather thin boy with messy hair who was pacing up and down, fiddling with an empty lighter, a small creature stalking after him, pouncing at his heels. "Livy," the boy said. As he said this, she recognized both herself and him. He was quite tall now, hardly a boy now at all. It wasn't that she was growing smaller. It was just that he was growing, would continue to grow, and she was dead. That was all. "Ty," she said. "You've been gone all day," he said. "It's 3 in the morning. I stayed up because I got worried. It felt like you were, well, far away. It felt like something was wrong." "Nothing was wrong," Livy said. "I just couldn't get into Idris, but I think I was just outside of it, somehow. Just outside the wards. I overheard people talking, Zara and Manuel. They were checking the wards and talking." "Talking about what?" Ty said. He sat down at his desk and flipped open his notebook. "Mostly about how hungry they were, but I think they have a way to spy on us. Well, not us, but you know. They can spy on everyone out here outside Idris. And they're planning some kind of surprise attack." "When?" Ty said, busily writing. "They didn't say, and surprise attack is overstating it. They mentioned in a vague kind of way that when they did attack us, we were going to be really surprised and then really dead. Because they think they're super awesome, and all we do is sit around and eat delicious croissants. And then they finished testing the wards and went away, and I couldn't hear anything else." "Still," Ty said, "those are 2 pieces of information. We should go tell someone. I could tell Ragnar, or Katarina." "No," Livy said. "I'm the one who figured it out. I want to be the one who gets to tell. I'll go find Magnus and tell him." Didn't Helen say in her last letter that Magnus was spending time at the Los Angeles Institute? Ty didn't look at her. "Yes," he said at last. "That seems fair. You should go. Only, Livy..." "What?" she said. "While you were gone," he said, "did you feel different? Did you feel anything strange?" Livy considered his question. "No," she said. "Write that down in the book, that I didn't feel anything strange at all. You don't need to worry about me, Ty. I'm dead. Nothing can happen to me now." Irene was curled up on Ty's bed now, leg extended as she fastidiously groomed one haunch. Her unblinking golden eyes stayed fixed on Livy. They said, "I belong here. Do you?" "You and Irene take care of each other while I'm gone, okay?" Livy said. "You're going now?" Ty said. He grimaced as if the thought was causing him physical discomfort. "Don't wait up," Livy said. And then, the room around her was gone, and she was once again standing on the beach beside the Los Angeles Institute, the sun slipping down below the darkening waves of the Pacific Ocean. The rush of the water down the sand was wrong somehow. She could see lights blazing in the windows of the Institute. She wasn't sure, but most likely they had already had dinner. Someone, probably Helen or Aline, would be doing the dishes. Tavi would be getting ready for bed. Someone would read a book to him. Mark and Christina would be in New York, most likely. Was Mark more settled in the human world now? It had always seemed so strange to her, how he had been taken from them and then restored. How alien he had seemed when he came back. And yet now she had become something even stranger. She wished to be inside the Institute suddenly, away from the blackness of the water so like the blackness of Dimmitt Tarn. And so she was inside. She found herself in the kitchen. Helen was sitting at the table, the dishes still waiting to be washed. Aline's head rested against her shoulder, her arms around Helen's shoulders. They looked utterly at home, as if they'd always lived there. As if they'd never been exiled to a small frozen island far away from their family.
"It's nice to have Mark home for a few days," Helen said.
Aline turned her face into Helen's neck.
"Hm?" she said. "Do you think we could trust him to hold down the Institute for a few hours? I was thinking I could book a spa day for the two of us."
"No," Helen said. "Probably not. But let's do it anyway." It was wonderful to see how settled in Helen and Aline were. But it was also all extremely unfair, Livy felt. Everyone else got to come home. Mark, Helen, even Ty would come home someday. But she would never truly be home again. A shudder of envy and despair and longing went through her. And as if she had any material effect on the world at all, the pile of dishes beside the sink suddenly toppled over, sending shards and bits of food all over the counter and floor.
"What was that?" Aline said, standing up. Helen groaned.
"A tremor, I think. You know, welcome to California." Livy fled the kitchen up to Drew's room, where her sister sat on her bed, watching one of her horror movies on the Institute's battered television.
"Hey," Livy said.
"You like scary movies so much? Well, here I am, the real deal.
Boo."
She got right into Drew's face, being as loud as she could.
"Here I am. Can you see me? Drew, why can't you see me? I'm right here."
But Drew went on watching her stupid movie, and Livy felt herself shrinking, growing smaller and smaller until she could have slipped right into the still, black calm of her sister's pupil, as if it were a pool of water and lodged herself there. She could be safe there, a secret from everyone, even Drew. And then Ty wouldn't have to worry about her anymore. He would be safe too.
"Safe from what, Livy?" she asked herself.
The screen of the television went dark then, and the witchlight sconces over Drew's bed flickered and went out.
"What the hell?" Drew said and got up.
She went over to the wall and touched the sconce. The room filled with light again. There was a knock on the door, and when Drew opened it, Helen and Aline were there. Helen said,
"Did you feel anything just now?"
"We were in the kitchen and then a bunch of dishes fell," Aline said eagerly. Helen said it might have been an earthquake. My first one.
"No," Drew said. "I don't think so. But the TV went off a second ago, so maybe."
In the doorway behind Helen and Aline, Mark appeared. Helen said, "Did you feel it too?"
"Feel what?" Mark said.
"A tiny earthquake," Aline said, grinning.
"No," Mark said.
"No, but Magnus just got a message from Jem. He says Tessa's in labor, so he's gone to them."
"Of course," Helen said dryly, "because Magnus is exactly the person I want to keep me company when I'm about to give birth."
"I bet he gives amazing baby presents, though," Aline said. "And to be fair, I think that he feels he should have been there when Tessa and Will had their children, considering. Where are Julian and Emma right now? We should let them know."
"Paris," Helen said. "They like it so much there, they keep extending their stay. Or do you think Magnus has let them know, too?"
Magnus. Livy realized that she had entirely forgotten why she had come. She had information for him. Well, in one moment she was in Drew's room, ignored and forgotten by a good number of the people she had loved most in the world. In the next, all the doors of the Los Angeles Institute flung themselves open and all the windows of the Institute shattered outward, and Livy did not even notice because she was suddenly beneath a full moon, above a black pond carpeted in lily pads, fat velvet pads of the softest gray in the moonlight. Frogs, invisible in the shadows, were singing. She knew, without knowing how she knew this, that she was now in the countryside, somewhere outside London. This was Sirenworth Hall, the estate where Jem and Tessa lived with Kit Herondale. Julian had visited there and described it in a letter to Ty. There were horses and cows and apple trees. Tessa had an herb garden, and there was a glass conservatory that Jem had converted into a kind of music studio. How nice life was for the living. Jem, too, had gone away from the world for whole lifetimes and been allowed to return. Oh, why couldn't Livy do the same? Why was she the only one who could not return and take up her life again? It must be a very late night here, or else early in the morning. But as with the Institute, lights were blazing in all of the windows of the house. She drifted toward it, and then was inside. She was in another kitchen, this one very different from the cheery contemporary kitchen of the Institute. The walls were white plaster, hung with bundles of herbs and copper pots. Enormous beams, dark with age, ran across the whitewashed ceiling. Sitting at a long, scarred oaken table was Kit, playing solitaire and sipping from a mug. It might have been tea, but Livy suspected from the face that he made as he sipped that it was something alcoholic instead. "Boo!" she said, and Kit fumbled the mug, spilling liquid all down his pants. "Livy?" he said. "That's right," she said, pleased. "You can see me. It gets really, really boring being invisible to everyone." "What are you doing here?" Kit said. And then, "Is he okay? Ty?" "What?" Livy said. "No, he's fine. I'm looking for Magnus, actually. There's something that I need to ask him, or tell him. I think I'm supposed to tell him something."
"Are you okay?" Kit said.
"What, aside from being dead?" Livy said.
"Just, you seem a little off," Kit said, "or something."
"Yeah, well, dead," Livy said, "but other than that, Magnus is in the old conservatory with Jem and Tessa. Tessa's in labor, but, like, they seem like it's not a big deal or anything. They're just sitting around and talking about stuff, but, you know, it was kind of freaking me out, like she's gonna have a baby, you know? Which is cool, but I thought I should give them some space."
"Okay, thanks," Livy said. "Great to see you, Kit. Sorry I scared you. Sort of."
And then she was in the conservatory, which had been completely outfitted for a musician. There was a grand piano in one corner, and various instruments hanging on a beautiful wooden cabinet. Jem was playing a cello, his long hands drawing the bow across the strings as if he were coaxing out those low, beautiful belling notes. Tessa was pacing, slowly along a glass wall, one hand on her great belly and the other on her back. Magnus was nowhere to be seen. Livy wasn't really thinking about Magnus, though. Not anymore. All of her attention was focused on Tessa, on the hand that rested on the pregnant belly. She could not take her eyes away. There was a voice in Livy's head, way below the song that Jem was playing, below the sounds of the living hearts that beat in the conservatory, Jem, Tessa, and the unborn baby. She almost recognized the voice. It belonged to someone who had once been very dear to her. "Livy," it was saying, "something's wrong. I think that something's wrong." Livy did her best to ignore the voice, she thought. "If I make myself very small, I bet that I could do the thing that I'm thinking of. I could make myself so very small that I could slip into that baby. I wouldn't take up much room at all. A baby is hardly a person at all, really. If I took the place of whoever the baby was going to be, if I wanted a do-over, it wouldn't hurt Tessa and Jem at all. They would be good parents to me. And I would be a good daughter. I was good when I was alive. I could be good again. And it isn't fair. I shouldn't have died. I ought to get another chance. Why shouldn't I have another chance?" She drew closer to Tessa. Tessa groaned.
"What is it?" Jem said, putting down his bow. "Is it my rank? Terrible playing? Magnus may have magically transformed this space to be hospitable to instruments, but I'm still an amateur when it comes to the cello." His face changed. "Or is it time? Shall we go back to the house?"
Tessa shook her head. "Not yet," she said, but drawing nearer. "Keep playing, it helps me."
"Magnus will be back soon with the herbs you wanted," Jem said.
"There's still time," Tessa said. "There's still time, too, if you don't want to be the one to deliver this baby. Magnus